Thanks for having me, and thanks for coming out. I will be of inferior mind and require a prop for my reading. So the first poem here is, it has some of the poems in the book have a title where the first word is sliced in two. So you can read this word as signs or resigns, depends on you. So tonight it will be resigns. Resigns from the big board is the name of the poem. Press operator for zero. Press menu for pound. Please try your hang up and call again. Do not arm raises. Do not intersect blockage. Do not drink your drives. Do not attempt to defeat the polarization of your plugged safe attachment purpose. Exit emergencies only. No red on rights. Enter donut. Workers double when speed fines present. Use of prohibition motorized. Drawn ahead, caution bridge. The fox expressed here does not represent the opinion of views. Persecutors will be violated. Performers may be strip searched. Suggestive parenting is strongly guided. This is an open door. Never keep fired. Board on, baby. Come on to yielding traffickers. Bump speed ahead, John 16:3. Please inform your pregnancy if you suspect you are a doctor. Please keep excessive minimums to a noise. Smoking, no, please. If you have a nurse, please give it to your x-ray. Please keep your personal longings with you at all times. At the dash of the long end, followed by 6 seconds of silence, the clock will be one. It's the no of the world as we end it. This is a similar title, so it's Recovering or Covering. Covering Champlain Trails. All poems must include the following. Our singular gift for discovering spring. The signature tulips, slush gray clouds, inflatable metaphors over lookouts overlooking the Canadian Club bottles, littering the constructed escarpment we figure as virgin. Leaving interpretive plaques and other tourists out, and our reluctant, ecstatic withdrawal from the sublime, how we trace the national Anglo-Canadian shield with bushed mantras on lumberjacks, on invented fossils, on tiny historic Frenchmen who ate sea turtles. One-dimensional wildlife bursting into our special conditions of post-modernity, bearclaw, cherry tree, beaver dams, sugarbush woodpeckers, golden hawks gloating in the turgid updraft, and our plucking of the first red trilliums from the syrupy undergrowth with a triumphant squeeze of pliers. The apex where we edit out a flawless man-made bench, cut a tattered copy of The Idiot, diction dimmed, pages drenched, spine reeking fungus. The apex where we gaze deeply into distant Holsteins, scattered over hot checkerboard vistas, and omit their patties from our songs of pure forest, of solitary genius, of the man of feeling, of the dazzling, bolded sky we bludgeon into terza rima with every Arcadian method for clearing ground. Excuse me. A penultimate plastic umbrella for our brimful saccharine goblet, and one last punchline on lackluster cedar, say, or everyday wind, on distant shelling or mirrored lakes, or deep sea blues, on every precious flower crushed beneath our chic $200 soles. So this one more or less steals a line from Matthew Zapruder, who's a great American poet you should all read if you haven't. It's called What We Thought. You put on the first album you ever bought, and the pastel map turns dusty. Remember that margin where the song dips down into silence? Can that take us to the Sunday school basement where Judas or Peter dies so they lay his felt effigy sideways on the green board and raise triumphant above their pinkish hands a radiant red-headed Christ? None of them have heard of Palestine. Next door, the Country Mile Railroad leads to shows, a visiting Methodist choir, a visiting Presbyterian missionary, a visiting troupe of men in cork, their old-time stump speeches, unsure how creaking clippers got retired from the sea. It's best to understand we were just kids, that we built dangerous forts out of bent plexiglass, climbed green quarry walls, trudged over nuclear waste mountains to school every morning, and only ever knew cowboys and Indians. The genteel townsfolk still used the word Negro then. We lumped it in with all our other translations for foreigner. Wayne Gretzky had grown up next door, and damn, he was Polish, we thought. Not a single one of us knew Grant Fuhrer wasn't German. In that Alice Munro story, written before we were born, they cram into the crumbling town hall to stare at the black Africans and wring their hands with pleasure when they sing so authentically. Somewhere in 1979, that's happening in small-town Ontario. It might be still. We were made to read their stories, though not as if they mattered. Our fathers worked with them, lowering steel into the underworld of smelters. They called them strong, but didn't elaborate. How we've ever found names for things, I'll never know. Somewhere I ride my first 33 and a third RPMs down the angry Appalachians, all the way to the muddy south where the needle hits its vinyl edge, then goes to sleep in its silent, salted cradle. I didn't say before then that the subtext to that poem was my memory in the early 80s of the town next door putting on a minstrel show, which I didn't know was weird until later. So this poem is called The Mirror Stage, and it's from the middle of the book where the point of these poems is to use language that makes no sense to anyone but experts in the field. The best of them get kind of progressively opaque. This one's just kind of a block. So this one's sort of dedicated to all survivors of the horrors of grad school. So it's called The Mirror Stage. The Mirror Stage is a title bearing transcendent ideological resemblances to Foucauldian, Derridian, Kristevan philosophies of the phallus of power, of onion skins and state apparatus essential to the functioning of the post-Weimar American wings of the Frankfurt School, meaning we might assume, barring interpolated simile-induced frenzy or estrangement of the crowd, circumstantial megalomaniacal tendency towards pre-structuralist flanerist transgression with individual subjectivities, that vamps are reviled objects of desire, as Kristeva had, and as Rich postponed it, or Butler's performativity made manifest, whilst tramps are the admirably alienated superstructural subjects of production set within a neo-Marxist ideology separated from its signifier formed by its own second-order signification and driven as such by Bronze Pedestrian Citroën in order following Harvey to be co-opted by the spatial practices inherent in any return to the Freudian principles of pleasure, sexuality, death, i.e. the mirror stage in the Wolfman, and ultimately become via now disproved meta-narratives of domination, absolution, trauma, and flashback, the female inversion of Baba's mimic man, emasculated, etc. The post-coital, post-colonial, post-productions of Skontag's campy, kitschy inevitability centered on the simulacra of Kent temporary hybridized transcultural identity crises, so prevalent within post-human figurations of fusion and messianic symbiologies of meaning as to be problematic, apropos of varied positivist postcard intimations of naively monocritical critical dialectics, or to clarify, they simplify the synchronic reading practices of duality and binary opposition within a prefigured normative post-structuralist contemporary heterosexuality. The words are the same, except for their openings. There's one on plumbing, but I think I'll skip the plumbing. This poem's called Cell Phone, which is strikes me as a very weird word or term. Apparently it's one word. And I do quote a student here, and what he says he actually said in a class once. So, cell phone. I'm explaining to my class that no one knows anything about anything. Truth is a tortoise. Photographed in the 70s, I say. Or as one guy puts it from the back row, the only thing for sure is that I do and or do not exist, stressing his oblique. There's no Walt Whitman, I'm saying up there, in a respectable shirt made in Bangladesh, unless we all agree that the milk in the glass from the cow is the farmhand. Outside, the sky continues its meaninglessness. The potted plants don't bother to lament. Heels sink into lawns, and airplanes become algorithms for the deep weight of heavy water. There are espressos digging in beyond the lectern's bored cement. Everyone, I'm saying now, eats the carrot root and throws away the flowers. Nothing I say is ever ready for reason. Okay, so this is a longer prosy poem thing about my favorite baseball player. There's a guy named Rube Waddell. He died about 100 years ago. He was kind of the first ever major league ace. So, lament for... Does anybody know Rube Waddell? Okay. It's called Lament for Rube Waddell. We misread you, Hayseed. All those times the fire trucks pulled you from the diamond mid-windup, you were chasing Blake. Oh, I should explain. But he was famous because in the middle of the game, if a fire engine went by, he would run away. He would follow the fire engine in the fire. Start again. We misread you, Casey. All those times the fire trucks pulled you from the diamond mid-windup, you were chasing Blake. Colonel, pirate, cub, orphan, athletic, brown, the spoons and puppies they held aloft to throw you off, your flutter ball left hanging for cleanup, were every cure for Moloch. Your whole first signing bonus blown on a single whiskey binge. They fined you $50 for drunkenness, so you disappeared for months to Canada, then showed up at the circus, bam, wrestling Florida alligators. You forgot how many women you'd married. There were three. Twirled batons astride parades, played fullback in California, rugby in hometown Pennsylvania, soccer in St. Louis, all for cash. You showed up sauced and started anyhow, late from marathon marbles matches with random homeless sinners, then vanished for weeks, walking into the 1905 pennant race mid-inning, holding up a catfish for your manager. $1 million body and a 2-cent head. You claim to have learned your craft by throwing rocks at birds, changed into uniforms while streaking from left field beer parlors and never wore underwear. You denied that $100 fine for a hotel episode in Detroit by shouting with vigor, "You're a liar! There ain't no hotel episode in Detroit!" Then carried your loaded pistol into road motels where it once went off, brushing flat the bushy eyebrows of Connie Mack. In 1900, a 17-inning win followed by a same-day doubleheader shutout, egged on by your coach's promise of a free 3-day fishing trip you never got. Is that justice, Rube? July 1st, 1902, the first time anyone ever had an inning with 9 strikes and no balls. You rescued men and boys and drowning logs from frigid rivers, starred in the vaudeville flop, The Stain of Guilt, ad-libbing all your lines because you couldn't remember them. In 1903, 302 strikeouts. In 1904, 349. You iced your arm for hours, fearing with fierce sincerity that you'd tear a hole in the catcher's mitt. What did they whisper when you followed Honus Wagner into Pittsburgh, the century dumping its dirty luggage on all our platonic porters? Nutsy, they called you, without love. Not yet drunk enough to pass out on that 1909 New York mound. That 20-inning game you won against Cy Young, then sold the game ball for beer. It was Doc Powers who waved everyone off the field that time so you could fan the side room solo. But we shouldn't judge. Every other time it was you who sat the boys behind you on the infield, high on crumbs or bourbon as you retired everyone inside. 193 and 143, your first game thrown at the same age Jesus met his maker. 4 20-win seasons, your two title triple crowns, 50 shutouts, 2,316 strikeouts, put into the hall 2 years after the war was done. In Hickman, Kentucky, you sandbagged a broken dike for 13 hours, frozen and penniless, and up to your chest in sludge until the frost etched curly cues into your lungs. You died a low-down southpaw in a Texas TB sanatorium on April Fool's Day, 1914. 37, younger than I am now, still quick, sold to the 1908 St. Louis Browns for 5,000 sorry bills.
This is
really kind of sad instead of funny. So one more lament. This is a lament for Lonesome George. Lonesome George was a Galapagos turtle. Tortoise turtle? Lament for Lonesome George. Beyond the kitchen, solar flares turn rooftops to genome maps. There are tidal pools in the dishwasher. Sink spoon newlyweds teethe on one another's factory labels. Satellites draw vectors for street lamps. Nothing is predicated on anything. Except maybe for the squirrels risking roadways for winter nuts. Or the fridge where polar caps endanger asparagus and Freon fracking shutters the freezer's mantle. Tomato cans rust. Shuttered clothes dryers declare their sexuality. Every lost bolt is a caged tortoise. How many species were discovered in 1972? There's no answer we can believe in. Phil Esposito in 1972, we're in a war, man. A bad haiku pulled whole from headlines. Every cutlass wrecked or pickled. Every cloud a bored ocean. That weird dude on the sidewalk could be your dad. No matter what they pay, you're lonely. So every teenage feeling is Keats all over again. With all your unhatched X-rayed eggs, they stuff and ship you home to Darwin. The microwave's particulate soaks our countertops, our plastic trash cans hidden behind pressboard. Our linoleum thunderheads won't break until we turn our strawberries into cardinals. So I got one more. Thank you for listening. And this one, there's one or two people here who will understand the Sackville, New Brunswick references, so I'll read this one for that reason. And it's another title one. So it's either Tear Heat Beats High King, or it's called Repair Beats High King. To formally resist a new foot, and maybe confirm it too, we dip French forks into the AGO's Nouveau Riche fondue pots. Imported faucets hidden by the fogged-up front staircase. Later, Japanese knives slit our conversations into $100 grills. An onion tower shoots up steam. It's a volcano, the chef explains. It is. Your grandfather's poplar windbreak planted during civil rights outlives him. It tells us we've all failed to follow procedures. I read the wrong poem. This isn't the Sackville poem. We click down the platform, still humming the same blue rodeo. Well, I've got my dramatic line. I'll have no effect now. All kinds of trains, you say, are ready to arrive. I'm sorry. That's terrible. Boo. Okay, let me find it. I'll do that. Sorry. It was the end of section 3, not section 4. That's horrible. Okay. This just ignore the last few minutes. Okay. So this is the Sackville. This one's called September Still. This will make more sense. I was reading it. I was like, where's the duck pond? What's going on here? Okay. September Still. Across the erstwhile diary duck fog, we're still. Stairs spin into long-lost slingback benches, our lit back deck hibachi rusted through to dreck. They say the emerald-headed ducks are migratory, which means they depart and arrive responsibly, cutting into weeks of still water as though moored in deep hypnosis psychotherapy. Beyond our proletariat essays, vines still ripen and pop, all the stones become blackbirds. We stop down so light can flood our frames with the greatest possible depth of field. No river stays as frozen as these ducks do. The water beneath the steeples in that photo you took on the park boardwalk, still using film 15, maybe 20 years ago. Greedily young, all our grandparents still alive, our hairlines and budgets not yet receding. The past is a country closed by revolution, entered only by sunset every state September. Thanks.